Children of the night, what music they make.
The Toth World Podcast.
And the Toth World Podcast is back, despite its host, me, Paul A. Toth. And this week's guest is Gabriel Orgreaves, who will be coming up shortly. First, in case you've been wondering where I am, I can answer simply enough. In the ethernet, the internet, the interplay, the play analysis, the psychoanalysis, the psychotherapeutic, the pharmotherapeutic, the pharmacy, and Old MacDonald's Farm. And while in all of these places, I reach certain conclusions that will change my life, if not yours. First of all, I have accepted that I am utterly and completely fucked. In fact, I am proud to be fucked, even if it happened when I wasn't looking. Yes, there was a bit of pain. Uncle Sam has big feet. But the pain led to pleasure, following nature's usual pattern. Thus, I decided that one reaches the point of maximum freedom at the point of minimal success, as success is nationally defined. And, of course, one reaches minimum freedom at the point of maximum success, as nationally defined. What the hell am I talking about, you ask? Well, if I weren't in a swirling hellhole of debt from pursuing the education that would supposedly have enabled me to become successful as nationally defined, I might not have the desire to get the hell out of this swirling hellhole. And if I had landed a job that would have afforded me the hollow luxury of success as nationally defined, I would continue swirling around this hellhole as if I had been flushed down a toilet. I suggest, then, that everyone rethink everything. Take nothing for granted, because nothing is granted except grants granted to friends of people who grant the grants. So, consider the idea that there's nothing left to lose, and it's the perfect time to go ahead and lose nothing. It's the last thing left to lose, and since it's nothing, why consider it something, least of all an obstacle? Why, you can walk right on through nothing. And that's just what I'm going to do. Walk right on through nothing. Out the door, to another place. Adventure. And away from the defruited American plains. God's country. The country of commandments and, oh, freedom to shop. Goodbye. I won't let the door hit me in the ass, and even if it did, I wouldn't notice because it's nothing. This song is entitled LSD, which stands for Look, Listen, and Do, or a hallucinogenic drug. Listen closely to the words of wisdom at the beginning, and then find a quiet place and do what you gotta do.
People often preoccupy themselves with the end of the world. I look forward to the end of the world because it's a surefire way to shake up the status quo.
Now time for our guest, Gabriel Orgreaves, and I'm just going to let Gabriel speak for himself, so please listen to his piece, followed by his commentary on it.
Not quite there. One. It was Monday. Stoney was in the quarry. He moved slow, pushed the rusty wheelbarrow from one path to the next, careful to watch the rock. Very gently he passed the wheel of the barrow along the worn path. Rocks are not like people. They need nothing. They lay around peaceful when not disturbed. They do not ask questions. Yet rocks are like some people. They are vacant and empty of importance, like Stony. No rock is able to think about itself or to know itself. There is no mirror in which the rock can recognize its face. No rock can do anything intentionally. It cannot help but sit, and its lack of motion has no meaning, since a rock cannot reason or dream. It had often been unsafe and insecure in the quarry. The region of dynamite explosions and stone shards that flew was separated from the road by a high chain-link fence with warning signs, and the sounds of the large trucks that passed they disturbed what little peace there was. Stony ignored the sounds. Over time he had grown deaf. It came upon him slow, and he did not notice, like the eating away of lichen on the surface of an old stone. Also, the sounds and the turmoil and the explosions had diminished from day to day as the quarry business went under. Though Stony had never stepped outside the quarry, he was not curious about life outside the fence. He was not curious about life inside. He was not curious. It was Monday. Stony was in the quarry. He moved slow, pushed the wheelbarrow from one path to the next, careful to watch the rocks. The cinder block building at the front part of the quarry where the boss man worked might just as well have been another part of the universe. Cars parked around it. People went inside and outside and drove off. In the rear of the maintenance shed that faced away from the quarry and away from the world, Stony had his small room and his bathroom and his path that led to the heart of the quarry. When the rain struck upon and rattled the corrugated metal roof, Stony did not hear it. In the shelter from the weather, he would hold on to his collection of special rocks, his favorites. He would hold them close to his breast. He would nestle with them in his bed. On cold nights, sleep with them curled beneath his thighs. What was particularly nice about the quarry was that, at any moment, standing in the narrow path or amidst the broken rock, Stony could start to wander, never to know whether he was going forward or backward, unsure whether he was ahead of or behind his next step. All that mattered was to move the barrow in its vacant time like a never-tumbled rock. Once in a while, Stony would sit on a rock and not think. Nothing was easy for Stony, and like a sun-basked lizard, he could sit for hours. The wind, mindless of direction, intermittently pushed up clouds of quarry dust that settled evenly, whitened the flat surfaces, which waited patiently to be rinsed by the rain and dried by the sun. And yet, with all its stillness, even at the peak of noon, the quarry held a mysterious and intimate biosphere. Under every rock lay a centipede or a lonely spider. Stony did not care to know which was more important, the quarry's muted surface or the life that grew within it. Stony did not care. It was all the same to the rock. For example, there were some stone slabs cut for retail, then forgotten when the purchaser's deposit check bounced, stacked over near the south wall. Beneath them lived a family of chipmunks in complete disregard of the bustle and noise of the quarry. Like albino fish in a cave, like Stony, they were deaf chipmunks adapted to their environment. Stony did not care. Stony sat in his own light, his own color, in his own time. When he placed his hands down upon the rock, he followed the law of gravity that forever pushed all limbs downward. Everything for him, when he sat on a rock, was as one. In this vacant world, the vibration of the bedrock in the quarry was the lone aid of a deaf man. When he changed the pressure of his hand upon the surface of the rock, first lightly touched, then hard pressed, he could change himself. He could go through phases, as the quarry wind and the rain went through phases. But he could change as he wished if he twisted his palm backward and forward with varied pressure. In some cases, he could spread out his consciousness into the rock and not stop until he was elsewhere within. If he moved his hands against the rock, Stoney could bring the world of the rock inside. Thus he came to nothing. The rock looked like Stoney. He sank into the rock like sunlight and fresh air and mild rain. The being of rock entered Stoney, and Stoney floated into the rock, buoyed inward by a force he did not hear or speak. He suddenly saw the yellow front loader move above his head and the face of the straw boss at the control. Reluctantly, he got up, careful to lift his hands free of the rock, to take it slowly to become himself now separate from the quarry, and he stepped to the handles of the barrow. The straw boss leaned out of the cab of the front loader and flapped his arms. Stoney did not like the straw boss. Mike Pernet had come to work at the quarry as a cutter some time after Julio Gutierrez had gotten hurt. Mike was the last holdout. He was fat. He was from the local community. He smelled of bad cheese. Stoney did not understand. How could he? As a rule, Stoney had little to do with the straw boss or the outside world that he invaded from. Stoney had never eaten cheese except on the crackers that he got from Bob's roach coach. Now Mike wanted Stoney to come up to the office real quick. Stoney pushed the barrow along the upper path that led toward the quarry office. He did not trust the lower path since the time Julio Gutierrez had been trapped beneath a stone fall for hours before they had to amputate his leg. Stoney pushed the barrow along the upper path until he reached the rear entrance of the office. The last time he had seen this part of the office, the walls of the quarry, now tall and lofty, had been quite small and insignificant. He caught sight of his reflection in the large glass window. Stoney saw his image as a small pebble, and then through the blinds of the window, the boss man busy on the phone in a black chair at his desk with papers and folders and empty beer cans around. The boss man's hair was gray, his hands wrinkled and shriveled. The boss man breathed heavy and smoked a cigar. The boss man always smelled of tobacco and moldy underwear. Stoney let the barrow down, then walked through the entrance door. The office, a simple space with walls covered with pinups of stone pictures and rate charts, seemed otherwise empty. The blinds of the windows barely admitted daylight. Slowly, Stoney looked around at the desks and copy machines and telephones covered over with plastic sheet. Beneath the flicker of the fluorescence, he looked at the walls absent of posters where the yellow paint had turned to gray smudge. He looked at the carpet that bore stains of stone dust. There were no words between Stoney and the boss man. There could be none. Stoney could not hear, and he could not read. He could not write, and the boss man was not very good at pantomime. Stoney was like a rock, and it was the boss man himself who had sheltered him in the quarry ever since Stoney was a child. Stoney's mother had died a few minutes before he was born. No one could tell Stoney who his father was. No one could tell Stoney where he was born. He could have come out from under a rock for all that anyone knew. No one could tell Stoney that he had once had parents. No one could tell Stoney very much. Stoney would never be able to understand what others were saying to him or around him. He had hints on occasion, but they were mostly images of solid grayness. Stoney was to work in the quarry, where he would push the barrow. He would be as one of them, quiet, a rock set in the sunshine and heavy with dampness when it rained. His name was Stoney because it was. He had no family. Although his mother had been plain of appearance, her mind had been as solid as his. The dense compaction of his immovable brain, the bedrock from which all his thoughts froze, had been stalled forever. Therefore, he could not look for a place in the life led by people outside the quarry gate. The limit of Stoney's life was his quarters and the quarry. He must not enter other parts of the quarry or walk out onto the road. His food would always be from Bob's roach coach. No one else besides the straw boss was allowed to enter the quarry. Only the boss man himself might walk and sit in the quarry. Stoney was often forgotten. It was Tuesday. The boss man shouted into the phone. He turned and he saw Stoney, and then he pointed to the desk. Stoney approached. The boss man in his dilapidated boss chair was propped against the wall and seemed poised intently, as if he listened to the ring of a stone wedge struck by a hammer. His shoulders sloped down at the sharp angles, and his head, like a heavy stone, hung to one side. Stoney stared into the boss man's face. It was gray, and only one eye remained open, like the eye of the sick crow that could often be seen in the quarry. The boss man put down his phone. He went to the desk and pulled out a lower drawer and removed the cash box, emptied it out. He stuffed the loose money, less than 100, in his shirt pocket. He then went outside and got in his pickup truck and drove away. Stoney gazed at the boss man's empty chair for nearly 2 hours. Then he walked out. The boss man had smelled funny of tobacco and moldy underwear. Stoney sat on a rock in the quarry and was one. Reluctantly, he got up, careful to lift his hands free of the rock, to take it slowly to become himself now separate from the quarry, and he stepped to the handles of the barrow. 2. It was Thursday. Stoney sat on a rock in the quarry. He did not hear the sounds that came from the office. He looked up and saw the ambulance and the police cars parked in the lot just inside of the quarry gate. Hidden behind a large cube of cut stone, he watched them carry out the boss man's body. When they left, they shut the gate behind. Stoney sat on a rock and was one. Days passed and no one came, not even Bob's roach coach. Stoney ate sardines, steel pretzels, and spoons of uncooked lemon-lime gelatin. Each day he rose early and went into the quarry and pushed his barrow. It was all in order. It had rained during the night. He sat down on a rock and dozed in the sun. As long as one does not look at it, the world will not exist. It only began to exist, as it is, when God turned to look at it. We know this from Genesis. God is responsible for all of this. Otherwise, like a mirage, a few more Mondays are nothing. Only when God looks does the world stay in one's mind before it is erased and blank. The world is as a dead rock or the eye of a sick crow. The same is true of Stoney. If God look at him, he can exist. And for Stoney to exist, you must look inward also. Otherwise, his image will blur and fade out to nothing, and he will be forgotten. Stoney is missed from not being watched. And there is no God without this dumbness of the rock that is Stoney. Stoney had no presentiment of a future. He was contented. The boss man had died. We know this. There is nothing to be known by Stoney, good or evil, from this death or from any death. It simply was not life. No, it simply was not anything. Stoney, like a rock, did not know of life or death, but he was hungry just the same. When Stoney saw the gate pushed open by the small child that was no longer him, he sat and watched and did nothing. His barrow had a flat. He was tired and hungry, did not want to push where it would wander off the path and crush and scrape against the bare rock. In the past, whenever the barrow had a flat, it was repaired by the straw boss, and before that, Julio Gutierrez. Stoney had not seen the straw boss for more than a week. There were tools in the front portion of the maintenance shed with which to make the repair, but Stoney did not know them. God may have known them, though this God was a typically inept entity that had no more clue than the boss man how to pantomime. But it was not for Stoney to see or to know. A chimp would have more use of a stick than Stoney. The workshop of the shed was dark with no electricity and smelled of oil and burnt straw. There was not the life of warm sun on rock inside the shed. Stoney remained outside. The child that trespassed picked up and threw a rock at the plate glass window of the empty office building. The window broke with a sound that Stoney did not hear. The glass shattered. Stoney sat silent in the sunlight as one with the rock. It was Wednesday. Early in the day when Stoney put on his work clothes, his jeans, a pair of large sunglasses, his canvas coat, and his hat, he filled a cloth sack with empty tubes of toothpaste and his favorite rocks. He carefully trimmed and combed his beard. Stoney was driven by his hunger. He wandered over to the barrow and felt of the oak handles, lifted the weight of the metal body. He set the barrow down. All was at peace there. He set the sack down, and then he set himself down on the rock and felt of it. It was Friday early when Stoney put on his work clothes. It was Monday. Stoney had left the limit of the quarry, but he did not particularly know this. Outside the quarry, the world was another kind of gray, less blackened, more tan with hints of umber. Other than for the gate and the fence, there was no boundary distinction between one place and another. Gray is gray. It had taken Stoney several hours to meander around the quarry from his room to the gate, to his room to the quarry to the gate. He would stop and sit on a rock and feel one with it. The rock did not move, and hardly did it seem that Stoney would move any faster. The instinct of life, unlike with a lifeless rock, pushes one around, and Stoney eventually found himself as he stood on the shoulder next to the road outside of the gate. He did not know how he had got there, and he did not know where he was to go. He was outside the gate. Stoney stood alongside the road, but he did not know what to do. The idea of to do was not in him. The sunlight dazzled his eyes. The road was a darker shade of gray. It might have been an infinite slab of stone. For some time he stood along the road and looked around lazy in the early sun. Around him he saw rocks that he had not yet seen in their lives, and their lines were unfamiliar and their angles oddly shattered and without pattern. They seemed to reach toward him. It was as if God had seen them and absent-minded had left them there with fossils, and Stoney had found them shiny. There was a lumber truck come along from behind as he looked at the rocks there in front of him, and as it passed, a large board fell off the back, bounced on the asphalt, then flew up and hit Stoney in the left shin. He was struck. He had not looked when the truck came along, and he did not jump out of the path of the board. Stoney was in pain. He could not stand on his leg. He fell over onto the hard ground of the shoulder. He felt pain and cried out, kind of hurt animal screech. He bled. Stoney felt of his pain, and he felt of the rock and the deep earth that vibrated beneath him. He passed out. 3. When Stoney came as one to see the world once again, he rose up on his good and on his bad leg, and he left behind him on the shoulder the bag of empty toothpaste tubes and his favorite rocks as he limped his way back into the quarry. The rocks of the quarry stood silent and erect. Stoney felt with his finger their edges. Then he walked back to his room at the back of the maintenance shed where he slept. When Stoney came to see the world once again, he was not surprised. The road, the rocks, the birds, the smells were all as new as they had been. They were neither expected nor anticipated. He had felt that there was nothing to them. They meant nothing to Stoney. He began to walk. He limped. There was his bag where he had left it. The world had not changed while he was absent. In the middle of the road, he became conscious of the weight of the bag of empty toothpaste tubes and his favorite rocks and of the heat. He walked in the sun. The road went up a rise and slowly around a curve and shimmered in the afternoon heat. It could be a high or a low road. Stoney would not know. Now he could never return to the quarry. He had with him no map. When there is truly nothing in front of a person is the time when there is nothing absolutely behind. Behind Stoney was the bag of used toothpaste tubes and his favorite rocks that he no longer had the energy to hold high as he dragged the bag along to make a trail like a snail in the dust behind. There was a gas station with two bays and an office small enough to hold a coffee pot and a candy bar machine. There was a car up on the hydraulic lift with two mechanics and a gas jockey. Stoney was thirsty and hungry and limped his way into the office.
"Where the hell are you going, you old man?"
said Raoul. Stoney did not reply. Stoney would not reply because Stoney did not see Raoul, and he could not hear him. Stoney proceeded to pour himself a cold coffee into a dirty cup that he found there on the bare counter. He tasted of the coffee and found it bitter. He poured a few tablespoons of sugar into the coffee and twice as much non-dairy creamer. There was an unwrapped tuna fish sandwich that sat on white paper next to the coffee pot. Stoney picked up a half of the sandwich and sniffed it. It did not smell foul, but it was the new smell, the smell of fish. Stoney bit into the sandwich. Raul Menendez, who had come up in behind Stoney, then hit him in the back of the head with a half-empty gas can. Everything spun around, then his mind was blank. 4. Stoney awoke in a room flooded with sunshine. He lay on a very large bed. A bed does not feel like a rock. Up to this point in his life, Stoney, in the back room of the maintenance shed at the quarry, had always slept on a makeshift set of rough planks with a thick military-issue wool blanket to lie upon. His pillow had always been a rounded rock. His most recent pillow rock was greenish in color. When he lay on his bed and placed his head against the rock, he would hear his heartbeat, and he came to know it as one with him and the rock that he rested his head upon. Here, suddenly, he found himself in a bed, and he knew not how this had come to be or what it was that he felt, as there was no solidness for him to reach into. He reached, and it was soft. It was also white, with a soft pillow with pink lace trim on the cover, and there was an over-blanket of fluffy goose down that was thick that held Stoney's legs in tight to the bed. The lightness was not enough for him to reach into the softness. He kicked out with his leg. A pain pierced his leg. The yellow room smelled astringent antiseptic of sweet flowers. The overpowered odor of ammonia and sweetness that he was not in no way familiar with made him feel nauseous. Stoney pulled up his left leg from under the cover. The middle of the calf had swelled to a red-bluish blotch.
"Mr. Quarry," she said, "you lost consciousness. But meanwhile, we are at home."
She stood silhouetted against the second-floor window with diaphanous curtains between her and the cut of sunlight as she looked away from the bed and away from the room, out over the garden below, and beyond to the brick wall of the property, and beyond that to the traffic of the small town. It was a kind of gesture she made towards him that Stoney did not reciprocate. He looked at the ceiling lamp, a small chandelier device with metal ducts that dangled in the soft breeze. He had never seen such a thing. Their wings shimmered, The contraption hung from the ceiling at a place at an angle from the bed that caused him to look away to the side of the room, away from the window and away from her. For this angle, and since he could not hear her, he did not respond. She turned from the window, and as the light of the room shifted, Stoney also began to turn in the bed toward the motion. He was much slower than her, as she moved quickly in a jump as she lunged up into the air, where she then came down firmly on the side of the bed that Stoney did not occupy. Her bare feet struck against the bed and depressed the mattress that shook beneath him as she bounded up in the air with her arms out, her long orange hair splayed out against the sharpness of the sunlight behind her flying form. She screeched loudly like a crow, which had no effect to impress him other than the contortions of her mouth with those magnificent magenta lips. Stoney shut his eyes and in the rigidity of his body felt the bed shake beneath him as she came down once again hard onto the mattress. He retreated to his place within in desire of the solidness and response of rock and the core of the earth beyond. He pressed his palms into the mattress, softly at first, then firmly. His reach rebounded to no place and returned to him alone with this lustful animal bounce that avidly gyrated his torso. He found only this soft mushiness where he bounced and shook. So, with no escape, he once again opened his eyes. Without feathers, she moved like a fleshy crow caught in a net. The additional appendages of this naked animal that flounced with him on the bed were just that to him, additional appendages that flapped and bobbled on her chest. He was curious what purpose they could have when suddenly in one of her arcs in the pale yellow room filled with sunlight, she fell down upon his form with her legs straddled across the rigidity of his solid hips. "You're a nasty lot with the muscles, ain't you?" she said as she ran her hands on either side of his bare shoulders. Then Grace Menendez leaned forward and buried her breasts around the gaunt face of Stoney Quarry and shook him. He was smothered and spluttered as Grace came up from him to rip away the blankets and expose Stoney. It was nothing that he was prepared for as she grabbed at him. There was a knock at the door, and it opened.
"Not quite there" is something of an answer to the question, "Are we there yet?" And it is a work in progress, as if there is a destination to the journey of an implied goal that is not made clear. And yet, I have problems with the project in that it is a very narrowly obvious plagiarism of Jerzy Kosinski's Being There, which may or may not have been a plagiarism of a relatively obscure Polish novel from the 1930s. So it brings into question the artistic validity of a plagiarism in a derivative work of art. And as the hoped-for conclusion of a novel project would be publication, there is a question as to if it would ever be able to be published at all, as the composition is in no manner authorized by the holders of the intellectual property of Being There or to the estate of Jerzy Kosinski. If you look in Wikipedia, it says of Jerry Kosinski that he once conducted an experiment in the difficulties of new writers to get published. 8 years after it won the National Book Award, he allowed another writer to change the title of his novel, Steps, and market it as his own. It was rejected by 13 agents and 14 publishers, including the outfit that had originally bought it. Despite these issues, I continue to return to the project, as there are several elements that I find compelling. Jerzy Kosinski's book is a novella of 26,000 some words. It is far short of what nowadays would be considered a novel, the idea being that a novel is 80,000 words or thereabouts. So essentially, Being There is a long short story about five times longer than what would normally be considered a short story. But then again, it's not a novel. And the language is fairly simple, which may have more to do with the fact that Kosinski was Polish and English was not a first language. Which simplicity of language can be a benefit to the long-term fame and durability of a literary work of fiction? But it is not only the clipped brevity of the language that I, to a certain extent, exaggerate over Kosinski. It is also the premise of a central character that is something more than less than there. In short, not quite there. And it is working from a character such as this Stoney Quarry, that I want to explore a character that is almost all of nothing, to see how the world rotates around that emptiness, that vacuity, that nothing. A similar character to Chauncey Gardner being Caspar Hauser, as in the film by Herzog. In this case, though, Stony Quarry may not go anywhere.
I'd like to thank this week's guest, Gabriel Orgreaves. And for search engine purposes, the spelling is O-R-G-R-E-A-S-E. And if you'd like to stop by my website and shop around and not buy anything, that's okay with me. The web address is www.netpt.tv. Now, time for the quotation of the week from J.G. Ballard. Sadly, J.G. Ballard apparently has a very serious illness. Normally, I am not that touched by the deaths of human beings because, let's face it, few of us, including me, are all that irreplaceable. However, Mr. Ballard has had a profound impact on both my life and my perception of life. He interpreted the world as he saw it and filtered it through his imagination. That is, he is and always was what's known as a writer, at least as I define it. Here then are words of comfort for those who like to know someone else who knows what in the living fuck is going on exists. I would sum up my fear about the future in one word, boring. And that's my one fear. That everything has happened. Nothing exciting or new or interesting is ever going to happen again. The future is just going to be a vast, conforming suburb of the soul. Welcome to the future, and we will see you in it with the next Toth World podcast.
Children of the night, what music they make.